The terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001 were all about planes. Planes crashing into the towers, a plane crashing into the Pentagon, one plane crashing into a field when passengers tried to keep it from crashing into a building. We'll spend this hour looking back at 9/11, but talking far less about the planes and far more about the boats. Boats, ships, water vessels of all sizes were pressed into service to take people out of the danger zone in lower Manhattan and take them to safety across the rivers that surround the island. We get a comprehensive look at the waterborne evacuation from Jessica DuLong, the author of Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift. Jessica DuLong is a journalist, writer, ghostwriter, writing coach, and more. She has taken part in many book projects in many subject areas and published a lot of journalism. Jessica is also a marine engineer who served on a fireboat 11 years as chief engineer. So she knows both ends of this story. Jessica DeLong, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book is clearly a natural blending of your areas of expertise, but did it take you a while to commit to writing about it?
Oh, absolutely. I actually came to writing this book with a great deal of trepidation. I have a long history of not wanting to talk about September 11th in any way, shape, or form. And really what happened was we reached the 10th anniversary, and so few people knew about this absolutely phenomenal effort that had been made on September 11th. And I recognized that my discomfort, the anguish of sharing stories about September 11th, mine and others, really just paled in comparison to the responsibility I felt of documenting this history and sharing it. And I felt that responsibility both just to history, sort of with a capital H, but also to my maritime community who had assembled to perform just incredible acts that day. And it was so important that the world knew what happened.
Were you in the middle of this yourself? Were you serving on the John J. Harvey that day?
I was serving on the John J. Harvey from September 12th on, pumping water to firefighters on land. And so I was not there for the boat lift itself, although other crew members of Fireboat John J. Harvey were there. And my service at Ground Zero was firefighting related, so pumping river water because the fire mains and hydrants had been damaged and unavailable for days, actually. The only firefighting water came from the river.
Wow. So the John J. Harvey was retired at the time of the 9/11 attacks. This is an example of a boat that otherwise wouldn't have been in service, got sent out. Who sent her out and to do what?
Well, it was actually the Chase Wells, who was one of the original trustees of the Historic Preservation Project, which is what the boat is now, a living museum still operating, serving that purpose. And he actually reached out to FDNY dispatch and said, hey, we have this boat, we can pump water, you know, we can move passengers, should we help? And at a certain point, everybody sort of threw up their hands and said, sure, go down there and just see what you can do to help, because it just was an unprecedented situation. There had been no plan for this and how to cope with the multiple disasters that were unfolding, just cascade of catastrophe rolling out through the day, getting worse and worse.
Right. Well, you mentioned the use of the fireboats there and actually getting water from the river to the fire. You focus mostly on getting people off the island. People need to remember that Manhattan Island does come to that tip, and you got Upper Bay in front of it. You got Hudson River and New Jersey on one side, and East River and Brooklyn and Queens on the other side. So it's surrounded by water.
Yes, it's so interesting how easily, I live in Brooklyn, New York, and it's so easy, even those of us living in New York City forget that Manhattan is an island. And what you saw happen that day is that over time, the doors were sort of closing around people. So the bridges and tunnels were shut down. And the public transportation that everybody just relies on, and it just sort of makes you feel that we're all one big city in a way, once those avenues closed up, people were really caught in a bind. And also the geography, the tip of Manhattan that you described, even people who were here that day, even people who were someplace downtown, who understood some degree of what was happening downtown and just walked north, even today, few people realize that depending on where you were on Manhattan Island, if you were at that tip, you could end up trapped. So that literally the only way off the island was by boat, because you were pressed up against a seawall with a railing. And there are really harrowing photographs that I share in my book of people pressed 10 deep right up against the railings along the seawall at the southern tip of Manhattan begging for boats to take them off the island because that was the only way out.
Which they did. Now, as an evacuation by water, this one ranks rather high historically, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. In terms of the speed, efficiency, and just size and scale, it is the largest maritime evacuation in history. So a lot of people have the reference point of Dunkirk, which obviously was a very, very distinct, different situation. There were 338,000 Allied troops cornered at the beach. This is in 1940. And so they ended up being rescued by what were subsequently called the, quote, little ships of England. And this involved vessels of all sizes. There were destroyers, large troop transport ships, and ferries. But there were also little fishing boats, little recreational vessels. The mythology around this, this basically retreat is what it was, is that there were more, the idea that there were more just recreational sailors or weekend fishermen who were actually sailing these boats, when in fact there were very few civilians actually involved. There were a number of civilian vessels because they needed smaller, shallow draft boats to come in to actually perform the rescues at the beach. So they performed an incredibly important service, and they did so under fire, you know, from mm-hmm. airplanes. And so that was not what the mariners in New York Harbor were confronting. The difference is that Dunkirk was a planned evacuation. There are these great black and white photographs of people on the phone, you know, with those long cords, like mm-hmm. trying to marshal up resources. Whereas, and so it was a planned evacuation. It took course over 9 days and, you know, it was 338,000 people rescued. In New York Harbor, what we're looking at is a completely spontaneous, unplanned evacuation, no oversight, no top-down pre-organization, that happens immediately, within a minute after the first plane hits,
okay.
even when people still thought it was an accident.
On the other side of a break, Saved at the Seawall. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, we're hearing anew a story about September 11th, 2001, in Manhattan, where the Twin Towers had come down. There was wreckage all over the streets, a lot of systems damaged, public transportation generally offline, many streets blocked, obviously, bridges and tunnels off the island of Manhattan closed, and a lot of people who wanted and needed to get out, and they did, by water. That is the story Jessica DuLong, who's both a journalist and a marine engineer, tells us in her book, Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift, now out in paperback. You can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The stories of the people and how quickly they responded are impressive, not just the people on land who got rescued, but the people who certainly did the rescuing. And one of the first people you introduce us to in the book is Patrick Harris. What boat was he on and what did he see?
Yes, he was right. So geography will help here. The Trade Center towers are pretty close to the western shore of Manhattan, and the nearest waterway is a little cove called North Cove Marina, and that's right as part of the World Financial Center. So just a little locating there. Pat Harris, captain of the sailing charter Ventura, so he would take people out on these luxurious, you know, dinner bruises. He was there on his boat that morning, and he actually watched the first plane hit the first tower. And his the recording of his voice is really haunting, actually. But he was the first to inform the Coast Guard that this had happened. Now, at the beginning, of course, this is a land-based problem. This was not a Coast Guard issue, because at that point, many people thought it was a small plane. Pat Harris actually, at the time, saw a jet. He named it as a jet. And I think he just couldn't, the way he explained it to me was that he just couldn't almost get the word out because it was just too incomprehensible. But he was the first to alert the Coast Guard. And then, of course, there's this growing reality, basically, where people are realizing what's happened, which is that this is an attack. And then the Port of New York, New Jersey, ends up getting shut down to commercial traffic. And so there's this whole chain of escalating events that involved the Coast Guard that was initiated by Captain Pat Harris's initial call.
Now, another mariner, Michael McPhillips, was a ferry captain, and kind of above captain by this point, but he acted really fast. What did he do?
Yes, so he was a port captain. So he was sort of had a maintaining order and keeping everything running shipshape kind of role that morning, not just running ferries back and forth. And that job of keeping track of everything sort of was put by the wayside on land, so that he could actually, he took a ferry that was currently out of service, crewed it up, and then ended up evacuating passengers. And yet still, he's trying to actually pilot this vessel, to captain this vessel, at the same time as coordinating people, because people were looking to him and radioing him for guidance and for leadership. So at a certain point, he evacuates many people that day, and he also helps with first aid. What we tend to forget all these years later was that this was, even if it had been a small plane and an accident, it was a disaster situation. There were people injured instantly. Burns from the fireballs from the jet fuel explosions happened right away. There were people who had glass in them from the blowing out of the plate glass windows down there. So ferries, which were right there along the World Financial Center, just adjacent to the North Cove, were front and center. And the fastest way for people to get medical attention, if they were right in that area, was actually to board a boat, go across the river and about a mile to New Jersey, where very quickly there were ambulances on the Jersey side to meet people. And then as the morning moved on, and there were more injuries and deaths, there were triage centers that were set up all along the shoreline of New Jersey with these color-coded tarps that designated, you know, which severity of injury, so that people would be triaged appropriately. So that was Michael McPhillips jumping in right away to help and also to lead. And so soon there was another ferry captain who offered him the chance, like, I'll run the boat, you field the calls on the radio. And he took that readily, so that he could have more of a big picture view.
Jessica DeLong is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about the ad hoc Navy that formed on September 11th, 2001. In her book, Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift, you give us certainly some chronology on land as well, and in the towers themselves. Talk about the public transit workers' decisions. There were some key decisions made here.
Yes, there were. And it's tricky, because you talk to people who were there that day, or even people who were you know, watching TV, and certainly there were many people who streamed over the bridges to Brooklyn, for example. So there were some evacuations by land or over water, but not by boat. So just to clarify that, because I think sometimes that gets lost in the details. But immediately, this was a transportation emergency. With something happening at the World Trade Center, this is a hub that was going to affect all these different transit lines. So transportation shutdowns, the first of them, began within 1 minute after the first plane hit. So at 8:46, you have an MTA subway conductor initiate emergency procedures, and a PATH train dispatcher recognizing that there's a problem. So PATH, just to explain, is the
Hudson tubes. Yeah,
the Hudson tubes. So it's a train that goes underwater under the Hudson, and it goes from New Jersey to Manhattan is the quickest way to explain it. But the PATH train dispatcher ordered trains to speed through the Trade Center and spin right back around to New Jersey. So they just kept going through and made that loop. And that was some really good foresight that it's like, okay, yep, we're just going to keep going. We're not going to drop off people in the middle of this disaster. And that's even at the beginning, before, as we know, everything continued to escalate.
So we've talked about a lot of the workers here. Let's talk about some of the just folks, the people who actually got rescued. Tell us a bit about Rich.
Rich Varela,
yeah.
He's just such an incredible individual, and I don't want to give away the end of the story, which is just really, it's like almost too poetic to actually be real life, but it actually is true in terms of what he ends up doing for a living as a result, but I'm not going to give that away. So he's just one shining example of what happened over and over again that day among everyday people, regular civilians, making a choice over and over again to help other people. So the first choice, if you sort of look back retrospectively, that he made to help other people was he gets caught in the first collapse of the tower. So the first tower to collapse, he's caught in the cloud. He climbs over the seawall, the railing on the seawall, lands on the deck of the fireboat John D. McKean, which was an active duty fireboat that day. And the cloud consumes them. All of these other people are jumping on board seeking refuge. Many people jumped in the river as well, not making it to the boat. Some people, and some people not even just planning on, I'm just going to swim. I'm not going to be stuck here. And he's caught in the cloud, and he tears up his shirt. He takes off his shirt. He tears up his shirt, makes these little makeshift masks, gets some water to drip on them to try to keep the choking dust out of his mouth, and passes them along to anybody who's near him. Then he ends up helping with rescuing some people, some young women, out of the water. So he ends up, on the other end of the heaving line trying to rescue them. Then when the boat actually makes it to New Jersey to drop off passengers, many of whom actually there were some grave injuries, likely at least one death that happened on board that boat. There's a man who has a shattered lower leg, and he's there helping to carry the chair to carry this man across this dilapidated pier to the triage centers there. Then he's standing there, and just this is such a harrowing moment to remember, because again, we don't know the end of the story that day, right? We know it now, but at the time, this was Armageddon. This was the apocalypse. This was just every few minutes, things got exponentially worse, and it kept happening. So these firefighters are there, they're offloading passengers, they're looking over at Manhattan, and all of a sudden the second tower collapses. And Rich Varela sees the look on the faces of the firefighters who are just watching the deaths of their fellow firefighters, as well as the civilians they've been charged with rescuing. And he looks at their faces and he says, I'm going with you. And they're like, what? And he's like, yeah, you guys need help. And they let him on board. And he went back, and he ends up spending the afternoon shirtless, running around dragging hose lines. This guy is just like a telecom guy. He works in a comp data room, and this is how he spends his day. And then again, I won't tell you the end of the story.
Okay, but he wants to keep helping people. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Okay. Saved at the Seawall: Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift is the book by Jessica DeLong we're talking about the Navy, the impromptu Navy that cropped up to do this incredible evacuation of perhaps 500,000 people from Lower Manhattan after the towers fell. You can join us on the Exchange 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Talk about the boat that Rich Varela was on, the John D. McCain. What was it supposed to be doing that day?
Well, it was such a tricky situation because there's a wonderful engineer who I spoke with, a marine engineer on that boat, who said, we're a fireboat. What are we going to do with the Trade Center? That was the thinking that day when they disembarked. And they pulled up alongside, and the situation was pretty complicated, but just simply put, what happened was the chief, the person in charge, and the chain of command is really important in the fire department and certainly at an emergency situation. So the person in charge ends up going inland, and they're all left without orders because he went to go inland to get information to figure out what to do next. And as it turned out, he got caught in the collapse. And so there's all of this confusion. Some of the members of the crew want to stretch hose line because there are raging fires. And that's the other thing that we forget because of the depth of devastation that was happening with the towers. But there were some serious fires in the perimeter that were going on at the same time, separately from what was happening in the towers. We also forget that I believe it was 4 months after the collapse, the pile was still burning.
Wow.
So firefighting was a huge part of this, in addition to firefighters rescuing people. And so it was tricky because they wanted to run hose lines, but, you know, they couldn't. And then the captain was caught, and then they sent somebody else inland, Tom Sullivan, and then he got caught in the tower collapse. So it was just, it was a really frantic time. And once they returned after the second tower came down, they did set up those hose lines, and they played a huge role. We were tied up alongside them for days after, providing that Hudson River water to fight fires.
On that first day, as this impromptu Navy formed, did there end up being some sort of fleet coordination, somebody who acted as harbor master or something, just trying to direct traffic?
Yeah. So what happened? So again, the rescue starts from basically 8:46, 8:47. So at 10:45, we have the U.S. Coast Guard taking a facilitating role. So what happens is then Lieutenant Michael Day from the Coast Guard, since retired as captain, he does this really smart thing, which he teams up with the Sandy Hook pilots. And so pilots are the experts in the harbor. They accompany every single ocean-going vessel through the harbor to keep everything safe. So they can reproduce the nautical charts from memory. I mean, it's just the standards that are necessary to become a pilot are incredible. So he teams up with them aboard the pilot boat, which is really well-suited to do this sort of overseeing kind of thing. And he puts a call out on the radio. All available boats want to help with the evacuation, report to Governor's Island. And by raising the Coast Guard flag on this pilot boat and feeding information to people, now you have people coming from further afield. You have tugboats operating where they never operate. They're not supposed to be loading passengers. There are all of these potentially hazardous situations where boats going in shallow waters, potentially, if you rip out the bottom of your tugboat because you're in the wrong place, that's a problem. So they provided really instrumental information and helped coordinate and really facilitate what was already taking place, which as a leadership organization, as you know, the Port of New York, New Jersey, the Coast Guard has this really important role, and they could have gone in and pulled rank and really sort of stymied this really effective, efficient operation. And instead, what they did was they facilitated, which it was a really important choice that was made that day.
Jessica DeLong, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift. Let's come back to some of the people who were in need of rescue. Some people, you know, obviously because they were indoors, just sort of heard a thump or something, like Tammy Wiggs. She was determined to stay at her post, didn't think she should leave at first. What happened?
Yeah, well, she worked at the New York Stock Exchange, and she was just a few days into her new job. So, of course, she wanted to do everything right, and the New York Stock Exchange never closes, right? That's the mythology around it. And so she was very hesitant to leave. She was new to the city, so she really did not understand the geography at all. She ends up out on the street. Everybody evacuates the building. She ends up out on the street, and she doesn't know where she's going to go. Her apartment is uptown, but she's afraid of going north, because she has this idea, as did many that day, that the Empire State Building would be next. And so she couldn't really grasp the width of the island, if you will. And so she was afraid of going north. And there was a colleague who was at the supervisor. She was a real leader in the field. And she was there, and she's like, look, okay, you can come with me. I'm going to my home in New Jersey, and we're going to take a ferry. And so unbeknownst to Tammy, she's walking straight toward the Trade Center. And so she is then watching people fall out of the building and, permanently affected by those visuals. She and Karen Lacey is the person she's with. She and Karen end up entering that North Cove Marina, that World Financial Center area, immediately at the moment of the first tower coming down. And so they get caught in the debris, and they're actually the two women I was referring to earlier who end up scaling the railing, standing above the black water of the Hudson River and deciding to jump because they feel that that is the safest thing because of the just monstrous debris cloud that's coming down. And Tammy is such an interesting, she's a wonderful person and such an interesting person to speak with about this because she described, she says, I know it doesn't make any sense, but there was no oxygen in the air. So I kept dunking my head underwater to try to find some oxygen so I could breathe. And so it's just that the utter panic that's on display there is, you know, it still shakes me up to think about.
Yeah, that comment really stood out.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, this is a tough place to be in the water too. What kinds of stuff is going on when you got tidal currents, you got the river, you got all that stuff going on?
You know, the best way to explain it, I think, is that I did some research and talked to expert swimmers who have participated in a very specific scheduled swim from South Cove to North Cove. So exactly the same water area that many people ended up jumping in. So there was this expert swimmer in this race, and I think it's called Cove to Cove, and they scheduled the race for a very specific favorable tide. So the current is in their favor, and they have special safety boats to keep people safe. This woman described her experience. She was completely caught off guard at the intensity of the currents. She said it was like getting caught in a washing machine. And despite the fact that she was a really good swimmer, she kept getting disoriented and she kept, swimming west when she was trying to swim north. So that's somebody who's planning this and has favorable tide. Instead, what you have is you have this ripping current at that point, pulling people out to sea. And there were many, many people who were in the water who were rescued by boat that day, who were saved from the water.
They're saved at the seawall, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Jessica DeLong in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Few people can stand to look at the images of the planes on September 11th, even after 20 years. So let's talk about the boats. We've been talking about the boats in this hour because all kinds of boats, big, small, ferries, pleasure craft, you name it, took people off of Manhattan Island in the area around the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. And it's a story told perhaps most fully for the first time in a book by Jessica DeLong called Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift. Jessica, a longtime writer and journalist, historian, writing coach, and marine engineer as well. So she really melds her skills in this book, and you can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about Tammy Wiggs and Karen Lacey, people who worked at the Stock Exchange, getting caught in the debris burst from the first tower falling, jumping in the Hudson River, not finding much to breathe there, but a boat did come to their rescue. Talk about what happened next.
Yeah, so what happens is, a little backstory is helpful, which is that Tammy Wiggs is not just a recent college graduate working at the New York Stock Exchange for the first time. She also happened to be a junior Olympic sailor. So she has some wherewithal, some sense of the water, And actually, she has this really important skill that ends up saving her that day. So she ends up in the water. She recognizes at a certain point things clear up enough that she can see the bow of the vessel of the fireboat John D. McKean. And her first fear is that the vessel is underway. So she starts screaming, "We're in the water, we're in the water," because she doesn't want to get run over by the boat and chewed up by the propellers. And so finally they hear a voice coming, calling back down, "Who's in the water?" And that's the beginning of this just really, really harrowing rescue effort that is made, where the loop of the safety line that somebody throws to her pulls through. And in this great moment of resiliency and doing what needs to be done on the fly, Tammy Wiggs, who has only used very, very small docking line because she's run these little sailboats, takes this line, this docking line for a big boat that's basically the diameter of a Coke can, if you will, and she ends up tying a bowline, which, truth be told, I am a mariner. I've worked on Fireboat John J. Harvey for 20 years. I still cannot tie a bowline to save my life, dry, not treading water. But she manages to tie a bowline knot that that she ends up creating this loop, and she sits in this loop that that is, enables the people on the boat, including Rich Perella, who we spoke about earlier, to help haul her up while everybody's scrambling to find the Jacob's Ladder. So, really incredible story.
Really, but you know, let's go broader, not just in space, but in time, because there is a real history here of people in boats rescuing people who need rescuing.
Yes, you know, the details of that are really interesting, but I'll try to make it short. I get into this a bit, a fair amount in the boat, because I think that the context, the maritime context, provides a lot of really good information. So the code, the admiralty law of helping those in peril, which is a much more complicated legalese sentence, but that's actually established after the April 15th, 1912 sinking of the Titanic. So that's when it becomes law that if you can help without endangering your vessel or your passengers, that you must help. But when you think about it, other than the people who are actually in the water, this really didn't apply, because this was people who are on land. And so technically speaking, it's not the same thing is not at play, but of course the ethos of the community and just the recognition of shared humanity, where if you're in a boat and you see somebody who's saying, "Please, please don't leave me here. What are you going to do?" And honestly, that's what I heard over and over and over again in as many iterations as you can think of from mariners. They basically said, "It's just what you do. You would have done it too. Anybody would have done it. There was no choice. It's, you know, this is just human decency." And honestly, the big thing that I'm carrying at this point 20 years later, after being immersed in this for so long, is that they're right. That actually what prompted them to act in this way was not some essential hero, you know, essential part of their being. Their actions were heroic, but what drove them was humanity, was just this humanness and recognizing that when someone needs help and you have the capacity to help, you help. And so the big message that I want to send to people today, especially in the midst of the COVID pandemic, especially in the midst, I will say it was really haunting to hear the weather report with smoky, a little less smoky, pretty hazy. We are in the middle of a climate crisis as well. It is absolutely time for us to remember that we are interdependent, that we must take care of each other. There is no choice. And actually, when you look throughout history, that's actually our default setting. You see over and over again, catastrophes happen, disasters. The first responders, just by nature of the way things work, are almost always regular people, civilians. And you know what they do? Over and over again, they improvise, they use whatever resources at their disposal, and they help each other. They share food, they share blankets, share generators. People help each other, and we spend so much time in the media, in the world, talking about the nasty things that people do to each other. It is really time to highlight stories like these.
Absolutely. And case in point, Jerry Grandinetti says he wasn't looking for stuff to do, but he did stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because somebody said, "Hey, can you get that dinghy running?" And it was a firefighter who needed, some members of the company needed to join with the other members of the fire company, and he had the mechanism to get them there. And there are some great tales that happen along the way where he ends up getting dunked in the Hudson River like a sugar cube in nasty tea, and a lot of pitfalls along the way. But he just takes that next right step over and over again and ends up almost single-handedly with very little help at the beginning, rescuing so many people and getting them to safety in Brooklyn from Manhattan Island.
And just a small boat, a Zodiac, something like that?
Yeah, at the beginning, he's just running this little Zodiac, and then he ends up actually back at the helm of the dinner boat. That's what he does. He's a dinner boat captain. And so he takes his boss's boat, basically. It's not his boat. He has no permission. But he's like, my boss knows me well enough. And that creative rule breaking was so heartening because people had faith that they were so sure that they were doing the right thing that the regular rules didn't apply. And it was true. It was true.
Well, obviously, safety was maintained, though, and had to be when you're talking about some of the boats. And I having grown up in suburban New York myself out in Levittown, I didn't realize how big the Staten Island ferries are. How many people can they get on those, and how fast can they load?
Every time I say it, I'm like, I better double check that because it seems insane. But it's like 6,000 people or something. I mean, it's a huge, huge vessel. And there was this amazing moment in my conversation with then Captain James Parisi of the Staten Island Ferry, and just the depth of fear and unknown. And just to paint the picture briefly, I mean, he was talking about how he felt like he was running this big orange target through New York Harbor. It's this bright orange boat, huge mammoth vessel. The thing that gets me over and over again, though, is that these mariners offloaded their passengers on safer shores, and they cast off lines, and they turned their boats around, and they went straight back to the island on fire again and again and again. They kept making that choice because they knew that there were people there that they had left behind the last trip who are still marshaling along the shoreline who needed help. And even its most simple, even further north where it was essentially kind of accelerated ferry operations where people were not dust covered because they had gotten out in time. There were other places in Manhattan where there were orderly long lines for like 3 hours to take a ferry boat. Even in that situation, people were terrified. And what do you want to do when things are terrible? You want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And these people got them home, and they offered comfort and stability and leadership and calm and that presence of just like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take care of it. And the moments when they recentered themselves, the mariners, and just found that calm place, because the last thing that needed to happen was more panic, because that's when you really know that you're creating peril on the water.
And as you point out in the book, and I have pointed out already in this discussion, there was concern that something else was going to happen, like the Empire State Building was next. And there were rumors that got broadcast that were false, like a bomb at the Supreme Court. The F-15s, as you pointed out, did scramble. And did some of the people on the boats see them around New York City?
Yes, yes. And I mean, even subsequent days, I mean, then Chief Engineer of Fireboat John J. Harvey, where I worked for 20 years, he talks about sleeping in this hammock so that he could be, quote, sleeping, I should say, but so that he could be summoned at any moment. He was up on deck, and all of a sudden, I don't know if it was an F-15, but, this fighter jet comes in swooping, making this loud noise, and he nearly died of a heart attack because he what's next? Is it us or them? And so, yes, I mean, it was terrifying. As you said, the barrage of bad information was really, really tremendous. And the other thing is that from the very minute people who were actually located at the site, they saw horrific, horrific things. I mean, there were people half burned. There were people with clothes melted into their bodies from the first plane. And so everything, it was horrible at the beginning, and it just kept growing, and people really, really didn't know what was coming next.
Talk about the process of, you mentioned this is not something you felt like you could or should do, and basically shoved it aside for the better part of 10 years, it sounds like. Believe me, this is a book you should read with Kleenex in hand. What was it like to write that?
I, in all of the interviewing I've done, I wish I had a better answer for this, and I don't. It was really painful. It's been really painful to keep revisiting this material. It's really overwhelming. Every anniversary is, it's not easy. And to me, the deep responsibility I feel comes from, one, the immense gratitude I have for my sources, the people who agreed to tell me their stories. We walked together through their most horrifying, harrowing minutes, and they trusted me to tell that story, and they did so because they knew the history was important, and they trusted me to do my very best to get the word out there, and that's what keeps me going. The other thing that keeps me going is what I talked about earlier, which is that, especially now where we are in this country in particular, really looking back at some of the myths that we have in our sense of self as Americans and our history, there's so much brutal history that is a part of the founding of our nation, that is a piece of how we have arrived here, that has been overshadowed for too long. That reckoning is so important and so necessary. And we also need to remember that this is also a piece of our heritage, that we do come together, irrespective of political party, of region, of ethnicity, of all of these other, you know, class structure, all of these other dynamics that often divide us. And so it's so important to me that we can look to these things, these real things, these real people who made real lasting decisions that saved lives. That's a part of who we are as well. That's a part of who we can be. That's a part of who we have to be going forward. We can't be in denial that we're all occupying the same blue marble in space. We can't do that anymore. We are interdependent. And so that's the other thing that keeps me going forward.
Did any of the Mariners downplay what they'd done? I mean, it's clear from your telling. I mean, even without you, you don't build it up any bigger than it was. You just describe what they did, but it's heroic what they did. And I'm sure, did a lot of them tell you, "Oh, no, I was just, you know, I had something to do that day, and that's what I did."
Yes, and I think that's kind of, you know, I just wrote a piece about this in the Daily Beast. And I'm still thinking about it, this notion of heroes versus humans, or not versus, but like, you know, which is it? And honestly, I actually think that more of us have this capacity to choose good, that that's actually more often than not the knee jerk, is to do the right thing, is to help each other, is to choose compassion and kindness and selfless action. That's actually more often than not, and it's a capacity within all of us. And I think that what happens is we end up tamping that impulse down. And the more we can actually remember that that kind of kindness and compassion and looking out for one another, it is contagious. It is more contagious than the Delta variant. We need it desperately. And I think, yes, these were heroic actions, but again, it's not about this essential hero nature. They applied their professionalism, their skills, their experience, their training. You know, to be a U.S. Coast Guard engineer, I had to do shipboard firefighting training. I had to test for first aid and CPR and all these other tests. So there were really specific, very relevant skill sets and equipment that Mariners had that day, no doubt. And their professionalism kept things going just incredibly smoothly. I mean, it could have been so different. And I don't want to undercut that. I just want to put more of us in that circle of possibility of all of us being able to make that choice. Because, yeah, that is what the Mariners said. They said, you would have done it too.
Yeah, I got stuff. I got skills. I'll put them to use. Yeah, I love the idea that helping people is a knee-jerk thing. Jessica DeLong, the book is called Saved at the Seawall, Stories from the September 11th Boat Lift. Thank you so much for sharing this.
I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for helping to share this history.